What I have to say, I think I should begin with a little preface, because most of this talk is completely new. It's something that I've never talked about or written about before, which means there's going to be rough edges. And in particular, as I was sort of reviewing it, rehearsing it just before coming, I realized it's also pretty sort of abstract. You know, lots of it are quite philosophical, which is the attraction to a philosopher like me. But please hang in there with me if you can, because I think the end, the cash value, is really profound and important. So we'll see how it goes. And I'll appreciate any feedback that you care to offer later on. I would like to begin with a comparison, or actually I guess it's a kind of a contrast. My guess is that many of us in this room, maybe most of us, were raised as Christian or Jewish. And though, you know, Christianity and Judaism, along with Islam, are the three main Abrahamic religions, right? Called Abrahamic because they trace themselves back to the, you know, the patriarch Abraham. And they're theistic, right? God made us. But he didn't just make us. God also wants us to behave in a certain way, right? So for these Abrahamic religions, the central issue, the most important issue of all, is good versus evil. The idea is that if we do what God wants us to, we will be rewarded. If we don't, we're going to get into trouble, right? Now, the reason I emphasize that is the strong contrast between that, between Buddhism, and not only Buddhism, but other traditions that I call non-dualistic. For example, Vedanta and Taoism. In China. For these traditions, you know, well, certainly we know in Buddhism, yeah, there's a lot to say about ethics. For example, the five precepts that all Buddhists are expected to follow. But ethics isn't the fundamental issue in the same way that it is for the Abrahamic, right? The fundamental issue is that there's something that we don't understand about who we are and what the world is. We could say it's a cognitive challenge, right? We're deluded. We need to wake up, realize who we really are. So delusion versus wisdom, ignorance versus awakening. And that's a pretty important contrast. We can see how it comes out in a lot of ways. For example, for Buddhism, one of the essential teachings, as you probably know, is the emphasis on anatta, right? Anatta, literally no self. That we tend to have this sense of a self, that there's a me that's inside and the rest of the world is outside. That's the way that we see the world. When we grow up, we're given a name and we learn to see ourselves in the ways that other people see us. We identify with the name and so forth. But for Buddhism, that's actually not the way things really are. In modern language, we can say that the sense of a separate self is a psychological and social construct, which we can deconstruct in our Buddhist practice, like in meditation. Another example of this emphasis on, you know, waking up or understanding wisdom rather than ethics is the first chapter of the Tao Te Ching, right? I wonder, is that a book? I would imagine many of you here have at some time in your life read the book, right? The Tao Te Ching. When I was growing up, it was Tao Te Ching. Now there's the new way, it's Tao Te Ching. The T becomes a D. And in particular, I'm thinking of the first chapter, which can seem quite enigmatic, but actually it makes sense when we look at it in terms of this difference between delusion and awakening. Let me just cite that. This may sound familiar. The very beginning of the Tao Te Ching. The Tao that can be Tao'd is not the constant Tao. The name that can be named is not a constant name. Right? Very interesting. It's starting out by saying the difference between seeing the world as it is, which it's calling the Tao, and seeing the world in terms of names, right? Having no name is the source of heaven and earth. Having names is the mother of the 10,000 things. That when we have names, when we use language, we're dividing up the world into lots of different things, which have functions, right? A chair is for sitting on and so forth. Therefore, when you don't have intentions or desires, you can see the wonder of Tao. You're going to see the world in a different way. But when you have intentions, then you will see the forms, because we use the forms, right? This is a cup. I can use this to drink my tea. I have the intention to drink the tea, so I'm going to see the world as this collection of things, separate things. These two things have the same origin, although they're different in name. In other words, what this chapter is highlighting from the very beginning of the book, right, is these two different ways of experiencing the world. And it's important to see it's not talking about qualifying for another reality. Rather, it's talking about ways that we can come to experience this world in a different way. Because as we grow up, as we learn language, we learn to see the world in the way that everybody else does. And we just kind of take that for granted. That is the real world. That's the way the world is. And we don't realize it's actually a kind of a collective construction. And there's a different way or ways that we can actually experience the world. So that's one example, or two examples, right? The Buddhist emphasis on no self and the Taoist distinction here between the Tao and the world of names. This emphasis, again, not on ethics, good versus evil, but there's something cognitive here that we need to wake up to, that we need to realize, right? For these non-dualist traditions, such as Taoism and Buddhism. Now, is there anything else in the modern world that is saying that kind of thing, that's saying, actually, the world is quite different from what we think it is? Yes, right? In particular, what about modern physics, right? I was struck, I came across recently somebody who's talking about what we can see, how humans, it turns out, vision is about seeing, detecting a very narrow part of the electromagnetic spectrum. That actually our eyes, human eyes, can only see, get this, about 1/10 trillionth of the electromagnetic spectrum. Presumably because, you know, we evolved that way, there's no advantage in seeing the other parts of it. But it's striking that other animals can see parts of the electromagnetic spectrum that we can't, which means for them they live in a different world. For example, reindeer and salmon, along with some butterflies, bees, birds, and rodents, can see ultraviolet light, higher frequencies than we can. Whereas, on the other side, some snakes, frogs, mosquitoes, fish, and bats can see infrared light, which we normally can't. And get this, goldfish can see both. Makes me wonder about the conditions that, you know, And this point, you know, can be expanded more generally, you know, remembering that it's not just our bodies that have evolved, but our brains have evolved. And the point is not that in evolving, we are now seeing the real world, that it has to do with what helps us survive and what helps us reproduce. That's the important issue. Natural selection, I'm quoting some physicist here, no, some biologist, E.O. Wilson. Natural selection built the brain, our brains, to survive in the world and only incidentally to understand it. Right? So it's just a reminder. Maybe we're not seeing the world as it really is. Maybe we're constructing the world based on very limited data, right? But where it gets really interesting, at least for me, is talking about modern physics, right? Now, we could talk about Einstein and relativity, and how if you fly at 99% of the speed of light to the nearest star and back, then you will have aged differently than the people here and all that. But the really hard nut to make sense of is quantum mechanics, right? I don't know if any of you have tried to read much about it, right? It's very interesting. Science, you have this, all this theory that explains very well large phenomena like black holes and galaxies and stars and all of that. And you also have, at the microscopic level, quantum mechanics, which goes into the kind of tiniest particles and does a really good job of explaining that. But there's this search for a unified field theory because they're two separate theories and no one has been able to actually link them together. They work in their own domain, but no one has been able to understand, you know, sort of bring them together into one theory. Anyway, as I said, I don't understand quantum mechanics. I think to some degree I can get a sense of, you know, if I fly to Arcturus or whatever, but quantum mechanics is really weird. And so I was very heartened when I read a book by an Italian physicist called Carlo Rovelli. The book is called Helgoland, the name of an island. Anyway, he said basically no one understands quantum mechanics. Because basically quantum mechanics is this very complicated formula, this mathematical formula, which I won't say anything more about because I can't understand that either. And also certain probability tables. And what's amazing about quantum mechanics is that this equation works to explain all kinds of things, but no one understands why it works. You can't visualize it. There's a bunch of theories about how it works, but it's just an equation. So like we're in the realm of pure math. Carlo Rovelli, in this book I read, he said actually in his opinion, he thinks that probably the best way to try to really understand what quantum mechanics is getting at is if you realize that there are no objective things. There are no self-existing things. Only relationships. And when he said this, I kind of really perked up, because wait a minute, right? We're getting close to Buddhism now, right? Traditionally, Buddhism denying not only the sense of a separate self, but denying separate things. And then he went on to offer some of these passages. You know, he said some things that were just so evocative of what Buddhism is talking about. And so it really, that's what got me going, because I thought, well, how much might it be that quantum mechanics, what he's saying, might help us understand what Buddhism is saying, and how much might Buddhism help us understand what quantum mechanics is trying to get at. So what I'd like to do is read you, for the moment, a few quotations, short quotations from his book Helgoland, which I find very evocative, right? Basically, he's saying, the world isn't a collection of separate objects that is like, you know, these separate things here that occasionally interact with each other. Causally, he said, no. That's the way that we tend to understand the world because of the way we break it up with language and all that. In fact, well, here's some quotes. Instead of seeing the physical world as a collection of objects, quantum theory invites us to see the physical world as a net of relations. Objects are its nodes. Think of a net, and the nodes are where the net is tied, right? There are no properties outside of interactions. Everything consists solely of the way in which it affects something else. Kind of turning it around, right? Our usual understanding, there's all these things like us, and then we kind of interact with each other. We have tea and chat over whatever. And he's saying, actually, there are no things. They're just interactions. Yes, I don't understand it either. Another quote. The quantum world is made up of happenings, discontinuous events without permanence. Every interaction is an event, and it is these light and ephemeral events that weave reality. The world isn't made up of separate things. The world is made up of events, or we can call them processes because the events, you know, transform. Wow. Another quote, the world fractures, breaks down into a play of points of view that do not admit of a global vision. So the world, it's a world of perspectives, of manifestations, not of entities, not of things with specific properties. Properties do not reside in objects. They are the bridges between objects. Objects are such only in respect to other objects. There's only an object when there's another object. They are nodes where the bridges meet. Again, I don't understand this, but this is saying something really interesting. Yeah. The world is a perspectival game, a play of mirrors that exist only as a reflection of and in each other. And then he actually said, very similar to the Tao Te Ching, the world isn't divided into stand-alone entities. It is we who divide it into objects for our convenience. And there's another well-known physicist, Lee Smolin, in his book, Time Reborn. Get this. In the standard model of particle physics, so we're talking about the smallest things, all the particles' masses arise from their interaction with other masses. With other particles. No longer are there absolutely elementary particles. Everything that behaves like a particle is, to some extent, an emergent consequence of a network of interactions. Wow. And just when I was thinking, this is starting to sound like Buddhism, right? Or in particular, Nagarjuna, who for me is the greatest of the Buddhist philosophers. Just when I'm sort of flashing on that, he starts talking about Nagarjuna in the book. Right? He quotes Nagarjuna. The central thesis of, I'm quoting him now again, I'm quoting Rovelli, right? The central thesis of Nagarjuna's book, right, the Mula Madhyamika Karika, the big one, is simply that there is nothing that exists in itself independently from something else, right? That's the standard Buddhist teaching. The resonance with quantum mechanics is immediate. If nothing exists in itself, then everything exists only through dependence on something else, in relation to something else. The technical term Nagarjuna uses is to describe this absence of independent being. The term he uses is shunyata, empty. Things are empty. They don't have any self-existence of their own. They exist thanks to, as a function of, with respect to, in the perspective of something else. Again, it's hard to make sense of that. It seems like there's something important here in terms of how we experience the world. It's not necessarily easy to make sense of it, but it's pointing at something we sense is important, right? I'm reminded of a famous line from the Diamond Sutra, which is one of the most important Mahayana sutras, right? And in here, the Buddha is talking to one of his disciples, Subhuti. And another name for the Buddha is the Tathagata, right? The one who thus comes and goes. So he refers to himself. This is what the Buddha says. Let no one say the Tathagata, the Buddha, cherishes the idea, I must liberate living beings. I must help living beings wake up. Don't think that way, Subhuti. Why not? Because in reality, there are no living beings to be liberated by the Tathagata. There are no separate things that need to wake up. If there were living beings for the Tathagata to liberate, that would partake in the idea of selfhood, personality, ego entity, and separate individuality. Going back to the Four Noble Truths, we can say there's dukkha, but there's no one who has dukkha. Or maybe we could say the dukkha is the dukkha of the whole of the cosmos. Something else in Buddhism that Rovelli reminds me of is the idea of Indra's net. Is that something which people are familiar with, right? It's really important metaphor in the Hua Yen school of Mahayana Buddhism. And basically, what Indra's net is saying is, it's comparing or saying, you know, this world, it's a huge net, a three-dimensional net, not just two-dimensional like a fishing net, it's three-dimensional net, right? And at every node where the bits of rope or whatever come together, at every node is a jewel. And if you look closely at each of those jewels, you can see that each of those jewels is reflecting. What is it reflecting? It's reflecting all the other jewels. And if you look even more closely, if you have a really good microscope, if each of those reflections is reflecting all of the other reflections. So it's talking about this totally interdependent world. But it's very easy to misunderstand the metaphor. You can think, oh, I and you and each of us is one of these nodes, one of these jewels. And no, the jewels are empty. There's no self there. They are constituted. They are simply how they are reflecting everything else. None of them has any separate reality. They are constituted by the reflections, right? Often in my talks, there's a point where I stop and say, does this make any sense? I'm kind of hesitant. I'm not sure how much I understand what I'm talking about. But there's something really resonant going on here, right? Just like Rovelli says about Nagarjuna. So let's... I mean, I love this kind of stuff, right? I've got all my philosophy degrees. But let's ask, well, so what? Okay, what does it really mean in terms of how we understand ourselves and how we actually live in the world, right? What does it imply about who we are? Well, first of all, in and of ourselves, like everything else, the point of Indra's net, the point of Nagarjuna, and the point of quantum mechanics, as I understand Rovelli, right? There are no things. And that certainly includes us, right? As Buddhism says, we are empty. We have no self-existence, right? This is important because I often, sometimes I talk about this sense of lack that we have, that Buddhism teaches us, that this sense of separate self, which we kind of have, but it's not real, it's a construct. And because it's not real, we so often experience this lack of self as a sense of something missing, something isn't quite right, I'm not good enough, whatever. There's something lacking in my life. And of course, what Rovelli, quantum mechanics, and Buddhism are saying, right, what's lacking is you don't have a self, so you're never going to be able to make yourself real. So often we get caught up in what I call lack projects, which is to say, you know, without understanding what we're really doing, we get preoccupied trying to secure this sense of empty self. If only I had enough money, or if only I was famous enough, if only all of you would buy and read my books, right? If I were powerful enough or sexy enough, but it's like, you know, I call them the if-onlys, right? We get caught up in these projects that take us out of the present, make us preoccupied with the future where we're trying to get somewhere, trying to secure ourselves. And again, what Rovelli and quantum mechanics is saying, nothing there that can be secured. And that's really important to realize, I think, right? That those projects, they don't work. They can't work. Doesn't matter how much money, fame, you're never going to fill up an emptiness that's a nothing, right? But this emphasis on interactions and what was the exact word used? Say kind of presences or... I've forgotten the word I used here. Appearances. Events, right? What's it saying? What's it saying about my life? What's it saying about your life and the life of everyone? It's saying, okay, let's keep it personal. David Loy does not exist, has never existed as a separate thing. What is David Loy? David Loy is my interactions with everyone and everything. That's all. David Loy is the sum total of these interacting processes, these events. Relationships, that's the word I'm looking for. David Loy is simply all of David Loy's relationships, except take out the David Loy. David Loy is simply this empty place where all of the relationships come together and interact with each other, right? It's my relationship. What is David Loy? It's my relationship with an old friend like David Chernikov. And other friends that maybe I don't know as well, right? There's Barry and Chuck. Where are you, Chuck? Right. But also everything else. Right? My relationship with my parents, now passed away. My relationship with my siblings, my wife, my son, all of our friends, all of our people we know, maybe we don't know them that well, maybe we don't like some of them, maybe some of them are enemies, but that's what David Loy is the sum total of all of these relationships, and not just people. I mean, we tend to focus on people, obviously, but it's relationship with literally everything else, right? With this cup of green tea. With my pets, if I had any pets, no goldfish. It's my clothes, my car, my house, the yard of my, I don't like to think about this, the yard of my house, which is, and the garage, which is waiting for a lot of work, right? Everything. It's my relationship with the whole of the natural world. It's my relationship with neighbors. Do you see? If that's true, if that's all that I am, oh, and we have to add one more thing to that. It's not just my relations. But remember, like in those reflections in the jewel, how each reflection is reflecting all the others. So it's like, in a way, it's my relationship with maybe two friends, but if they really don't like each other, don't get along, in a way, that's going to be affecting me as well, right? So what would it mean to realize all I am is my relations? And again, the emphasis on impermanence, the relations, they're not fixed, they're not stuck. Like, you know, frankly, there's a problem. I got three brothers, and the relation with one of them isn't very good. But that's what I am. That relationship with that brother is not a good relation. But there's also the possibility of repairing it, you know, changing it, improving it, or at least trying to do something that way. What would it mean to really understand that and to live in that way? And remembering the Bodhisattva path. What does the Bodhisattva path mean in that context, right? Traditionally, the Bodhisattva path is saying we wake up, not just for our own sake, but we commit ourselves to helping everyone else wake up, helping everyone else become enlightened. But if there's no selves, if there's only relations, what does that mean in terms of how we're relating to? Again, using language, it's very hard to avoid the nouns, right? But what we're really talking about is a world that's all verbs, that's all processes, it's all interactions, it's all transforming events. And it seems to me that in looking at it in that context, what the Bodhisattva path is cherishing. It's like, well, guess what? I am all of these relations, so are you. It's like we're all interrelated. Nothing separate there. When I realize that, when we realize that, how are we gonna, it's like, what becomes of the meaning of my life? Where does love come in here? I mean, Isn't that the archetypal relation? Love, right? Loving the world, love, you know, repairing, healing, cultivating love. In all our relations. So is this a slightly different way of understanding and articulating the Buddhist path? You can say, you know, realizing that there's no separate me, I'm just all these relations. And then once I realize that, what does it mean for the meaning of my life? It's not about what can I get out of it. It's just relationships. And then the meaning of my life is going to be devoting myself to improving, healing, spreading love, deepening the loving relationships to everyone and everything. I hope that makes some sense. Thank you.